Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. Phil Topham here, Executive Director of the FIEC, and welcome to our first in the news of the new year with our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
And our Associate National Director, Adrian
would
Reynolds.
Would you like me to sing Happy New Year by ABBA?
No, I would not. Although it is the new year, and I'm pleased to report that my annual tub of Twiglets has once again made it to the new year, bought before Christmas, and still going strong.
It's so a miracle.
It is a miracle. Not all Twiglets have been eaten. Hey, it's going to be a big, lots going on in the news, which we'll come to, but it's going to be a big year in terms of FIEC. We've got lots coming up, haven't we? We've had today in the office two new local directors. So Paul Kinnaird and George Hawkins will be covering Bristol and the kind of East Midlands respectively. It's a great encouragement, isn't it, to see these men coming on board.
I mean, that's really exciting. This has been our big vision for the past few years, is to have a whole network of local directors across the country who are connecting FIEC and our central staff and the support and help we provide for churches with local support. They're able to foster relationships with local pastors, bring them together, help with planting, with revitalization, help develop a regional vision for the work of the gospel in those areas. And our local directors are a mix of some who are working full-time for FIEC, some who are working part-time for FIEC, some who are seconded from churches, some who are retired pastors who are giving their time freely. So our goal is really to provide national coverage. That's one of the reasons why we've been growing our income across FIEC. And we're really just encouraged that that has been expanding. At least half of the country now is really covered by local directors. And I think many of the churches have hugely benefited from having somebody that they can connect with who understands the local situation, but is also well connected with the central ministries of FIEC. So yes, we're really just delighted that Paul and George have joined the team.
They're not as new an idea as people think they are.
No.
We've had a Scotland director for many, many years, a London director. Yep. And in both those areas, people doing those roles have made a huge difference. And we can just see the difference they make. We and churches as well and our trust board want others to benefit from that as well.
And recording, go on.
It's just worth saying, I mean, it's important to recognize, like FIEC, they're not to be thought of as bishops or anything like that. They don't have any authority over the local churches. It's entirely there to serve with the consent of the churches, invited in by the pastors and the leaders and the congregations to help where they want help. So it's a way of providing the help and support for churches that reflects the fact that we are independent, but our key goal to be independent churches working together to reach Britain for Christ. Our local directors is a key way that we deliver something of that working together. So they are seeking to help our leaders flourish. They are seeking to connect the churches. And out of that, we're hoping to see the kingdom grow as churches are able to get the gospel out in their areas.
Another way that the church will grow, we pray in God's kindness, is leaders. And Journeys is coming up a couple of weeks' time. Adrian?
We're really heartened, Phil, by the number of people going into ministry. Mm. Often you see the headlines, says it's quite bleak. It's not quite as bleak, I don't think, in the FIEC as across the Christian world. And as the headlines sometimes intimate, it's quite a lot of people training for ministry of all different kinds, actually. And one of the things that's happened, I think, in the last few years is that training has become democratized. People are training for more kinds of roles within the FIEC, women's workers or for music leaders and for other roles. I think that's a really healthy place to be. But we always want to be encouraging churches to be thinking about, you know, who could you send into ministry? Who is it? Who is this right for? Who could serve in ministry? And the Journeys Conference is a really important part of that. It's in 2 weekends' time, so it's not very far away, but there's still time to book in. Mm. And most people book in actually in the last week, essentially. And it's a weekend really to spend with some FIEC staff and then some other ministry staff from around churches to come and think about whether the Lord might be calling you into full-time ministry. So we want people to come with the agreement of their churches, don't want them just to come off their own back. But we do want to serve churches in this way, to spend a weekend with you. So if you've got someone in your church that you think, well, maybe they would be suitable for ministry, even if not just now, but maybe in the future, we'd love to see them. They can find some more information online and we'd love to see them come along. It's in Daventry, which is right in the middle of, I was going to say nowhere, but in the middle of England.
We'll put a link into the show notes. John, do you know what's happening 84 days today?
I'm guessing that's going to be Rising Light.
That's right. 12 weeks today.
Which we're really excited about. We can't quite believe it's coming just in 12 weeks' time. This is a new event that we're organising in Torquay. It's an opportunity for people to gather together, to hear the Bible taught, to worship together, to hear from a whole range of seminar speakers addressing areas areas of culture and the Christian life. For decades, Christians have enjoyed the opportunity to be able to go to an Easter event of some kind for this sort of mutual encouragement, whether that was through the FIEC events in places like
Kester. It's not a new thing for FIEC, is it?
No, not at all. And then for Word Alive for a long period of time. Sadly, Word Alive wasn't able to continue, but we felt it was right to step in to provide an event like that. There are other things at other times of the year, but Easter, we thought, was a particular opportunity that suits some people, some churches. For us, as an FIEC perspective, most of our engagement is with the leaders of churches. We think this provides an opportunity to engage particularly with the members of churches who might come. We've got a youth ministry, children and youth being led by Growing Young Disciples. We think it's a really great opportunity to be able to connect with younger people in our churches. Students and young people, 19s to 24s, we've got a special lower price for them. UCCF are going to be running our program for that age group. I was really excited to hear this week that one of our churches is going to book 20 of their students to come to it. And we'd love to see more and more doing that. So it's a real opportunity for people to be invested in and encouraged in their Christian faith. So it's a really exciting new venture. Obviously, there's a measure of risk involved for us. We'd love people to support it. It's in Torquay. We're not providing accommodation. So that means to say that people have the opportunity to find accommodation that suits them, suits their budget. Although we have been able to put together some new packages of kind of accommodation and event in hotels. So a kind of a half board option that provides accommodation plus breakfast plus dinner to make it easy for you to book. And that's all available on the FIEC website. So yes, there's a huge amount of work going on at the moment to deliver the event. We feel we've got a fantastic program, an increasing number of sort of fun activities for people to take part
Lego.
In.
There will be Lego, John. Are you excited about
I'm excited about
soft
Lego.
Soft play for the young and young at heart. Very good.
Those who remember our Word Alive, Clownfish and the Inflatables are going to be there. So we think it's going to be a really fun time, but actually spiritually refreshing and encouraging.
It's worth saying, I've written an article for EN, which we'll put a link in the show notes through to. This doesn't undermine what we believe about the local church. It's a way of serving the local church, because actually we can do things at this kind of event that in the local church you just can't do. It's especially important for kids, actually, in the local church, who will often feel lonely and isolated. So this is a great way, actually, that we serve one another and serve the wider church. So
risinglights.co.uk to get your tickets. We've now got day tickets available. We've got these half-board packages available as well. So we're trying to make it as easy as possible for you to come along. And if you want to volunteer for our youth and children's work particularly, we could do with some more volunteers. So you can check all that out at risinglights.co.uk. Worth saying, a couple of other things just coming up. Our local conferences and our Planters Conference, they're on the horizon as well. We'll put links in the show notes to all that, but there's lots coming up in 2026. Brothers, let's...
Happy New Year.
let's talk about what's been going on in the news. I've entitled this first kind of story or set of stories as global instability. It does feel like that, doesn't it? Let's be real about that. The protests in Iran, lots of protesters having lost their lives as they protest against the regime there. We've got everything that's happened with Venezuela and Donald Trump now threatening to take over Greenland. It just feels... For the first time in my life, I'm looking around going...
And the ongoing situation in Russia and Ukraine.
And Ukraine. And of course, there's still sort of, although there's been a cease in hostilities, we've still got Gaza as well that's there. It does feel very, very fragile. Am I underestimating that?
I don't think you are, Phil. There's two things to say about this, really. One is the world is inherently unstable because of sin. And that is true in the geological world. It's true in the political world. It's true in our personal lives. The effect of the brokenness that is in the world is always there. But the immediacy of it ebbs and flows. So I think it is right to say things feel particularly unstable and uncertain at the moment. But that doesn't mean that 50 years ago things were rock solid. The inherent position of the world is unstable. And that's because the world is groaning, we're groaning, waiting for the day when Jesus will return and evil will be done away with. So I think we've got to be a little bit careful putting this in the wider context, that even though perhaps compared to 5 years ago, or 6 years ago, 7 years ago, it feels like things are much more uncertain. I think we can say that's true without undermining our overall theological position, which is the world is inherently unstable. I went to the RAF Museum, took a couple of lads from church to the RAF Museum. And the great development in planes over the last few years is fly-by-wire technology. The plane is inherently unstable. It's not stable. It's inherently unstable. And that makes it much more maneuverable and agile. And the world is inherently unstable. Mm. And that's because of sin. And I think we need to acknowledge that and recognize that, even though the immediacy of what we're feeling, I think, has been heightened. I think that's right.
And John, how do you lead when people are feeling that level of instability? And I agree with what Adrian said, but perhaps at this moment, people are feeling more unstable, yep, particularly looking at world events.
I think on one level, our fundamental theological truth is that God is in control and Jesus is king, that's and right, reigning and accomplishing his purposes. Mm. We have to keep coming back to that. And the Bible reiterates it time and time again. The Bible is full of times in which God's people found themselves in an unstable world, superpowers that were going to war. They found themselves caught up as a small nation in that. And I think actually that is, our faith needs to be rooted in our confidence in God, that he is working out things to accomplish his purpose. And he will ultimately, Jesus will return to establish his kingdom. I think we need to help people to understand that instability is normal. And I rather wonder if actually you said not in your lifetime. Well, actually in my lifetime, I think I've seen massive instability. So whether it was the Cold War with the threat of nuclear war between America and the USA, whether it was the American
USSR,
invasion, USSR.
Yeah. Pigs, John,
the,
for you?
Well, no, not quite that, but the American invasion of cheap, Grenada, Panama, Russian invasion of Afghanistan, the first Gulf War, the second Gulf War, much instability in kind of Africa. So none of these things are actually particularly new. And to some extent, I think we've deceived ourselves into thinking that things were stable. And maybe, I think particularly for Europeans, we feel more unstable because actually we've so long taken it for granted that America will be the bedrock of our security. Yeah, yeah. And I think what's increasingly clear is that America doesn't have an interest in Europe in the way that it might have done in the past. And there's a feeling that that relationship that developed after the Second World War is now diminishing as America turns its focus to other places in the world, and particularly the challenge of China. Mm. So maybe there is a sense in which we feel that insecurity more than we have done, partly because of the general decline of Europe and the UK in relative terms. We're not a strong military power in the way that we were several decades ago. And that alliance with America, our key ally, suddenly seems to be less certain in relation to us. So again, I think we are just learning the reality of the way that the world is. I mean, it's hard to know how to respond, isn't it? Because at one level, there are dangers that we see international law in various places breaking down, sheer power being used. At the same time, I don't mourn the removal of President Maduro in Venezuela. Venezuela should be a wealthy country. It's got much resources, but it's been led by a dictatorial socialist regime for decades that's impoverished the people and that has harmed the church and imposed restrictions on them. So at one level, it's hard to know exactly what God is doing here, but I remember the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the coming down of communist states in Europe, which again, we rejoiced over that led to transformation and change, the opening of new gospel opportunities. So I think even in these unstable and unsettling events, as nations are being shaken, that might actually lead to gospel good outcomes where regimes like that, I mean, who knows what might happen in Iran? The Islamic regime there has had so much influence on the world situation, so much hardship for Christians and indeed Jewish people in Iran over decades. It might be God's mercy that regime is brought to
and
an
yet,
end.
And yet, in a strange providence, even the existence of that regime, which forced people out of the country, exposed them to the gospel, and there's been a remarkable movement, both actually in the country, but driven mainly, the movement in the country has been driven by people out of the country, exiles, being converted. And then speaking the gospel back to their friends and families back. So it's this bizarre thing, God's sovereignty, that we can't deconstruct and fully understand, but we have to believe in. It's something to be believed in. That actually, even when there are those desperate situations, God uses them for good.
And I think we just have to keep coming out to the Bible. How do we pray in these situations? And I think one of the dangers is that very often as Christians, we think our job is to tell God what he really ought to do, as if we understand the situation better than he does. Whereas actually the biblical pattern is basically a prayer that trusts in God's good purposes. The burden of praying is above all for the advance of the gospel and for the protection of God's people and the concern of the church. We don't necessarily know what is actually in the best interests of the advance of the gospel and the church, but that's what we need to pray for open door and opportunity for the gospel to go out, for mercy to persecuted brothers and sisters. And we need to be like the persistent widow. We are waiting for the coming of justice and the coming of the kingdom. And we need to persevere in faith, looking for the time when the kingdom will come, crying out for God to do justice. In a sense, our ultimate prayer is, come Lord Jesus.
That's right.
Which is embedded in the Lord's Prayer, your kingdom come. Mm. And I think one of the challenges we can have of as Christians is sort of failing to pray in the way the Bible calls us to pray, which anticipates we have limited knowledge of what God is doing and why he's doing it. And we fall into, in a sense, trying to anticipate God rather than actually praying confident in God in the way that scripture teaches us.
How do we feel about the language that the President of the United States has been using in some of this? I think I'm right in quoting him as saying, the only restraint on power is my own morality.
Well, he has said that, although he's said lots of other things well. And I think part of the trouble we have with analysing Donald Trump as a leader is we don't see everything. We're not quite close enough to it.
To have a mediated version of him.
Indeed. Yeah. And whatever your particular background is or whatever your particular news outlet is, you're having a curated view of what he's saying. And we're not hearing a load of the other stuff he's doing. Mm. So we're, you know, you're not hearing that he's also signed a presidential declaration to allow showers to deliver more water in the States, for example. So, you know, we're seeing things in a, which is true, by the way. And it's, we're just seeing a very, very narrow little window. And so I think we've got to be a little bit careful. And I think it's also clear with President Trump in particular, that what he says is not necessarily what he means.
Mm.
I mean, I find that difficult personally. I want my politicians to be a bit more transparent and have a bit more integrity in their speech. But it's clear that he's a deal maker and he spouts off all kinds of things in order to make deals and make the best deals. And he'll say one thing to one person and one thing to another. And that's just kind of the deal maker in him, I think. And that's his modus operandi. So I think we've got to be a little bit careful judging President Trump by
the sound bites.
The sound bites, and also an objective standard of what we think leadership should be. I mean, he's not a church leader. If he was a church leader, we might well say different things about him. He does have a strange relationship, I think, with those around him. I've been following the story of the shoes. Have you seen the story of the shoes?
Only you told me about it earlier, and I know you were keen to share it here.
So, I mean, I think this is more telling, I think, to me, that he was quite cross with Rubio and Hesketh's shoes, the Secretary for War and the Secretary of State, sorry, in reverse order, Rubio's Secretary of State. He said their shoes weren't good enough, and then he sort of mocked their shoes. So he bought them both a pair of shoes, several sizes too big. I mean, several sizes too big. And there's some wonderful shots of Rubio walking around the White House wearing these shoes, which must have been very uncomfortable. There's like an inch of gap at the back of the shoe. At which point you think, well, if you're wearing a shoe, why are you wearing those shoes? Just to please the leader? Well,
is that what it reveals, do you think?
I think it probably does. And so I think he is a very, very dominant leader. And maybe the world needs a dominant leader. And maybe America does. Maybe it doesn't. That's a political question that listeners can answer for themselves. But he clearly is a very dominant leader that people struggle to stand up to. And when they do, I mean, there's a story even today in the press about the head of the Federal Reserve. They've opened a criminal investigation against him. But possibly, probably, who knows, because he stood up to President Trump. So he's clearly a particular kind of leader that I have problems with and I don't think is a Christian model of leadership. But having said that, there are certain circumstances where that's a very effective model of leadership. So we have to be a little bit careful judging things by Christian standards all the time in the secular world. Mm. But we can draw lessons and say, what kind of leaders do we want to be? We want to be the kinds of leaders actually who are servant leaders. We want to be the kind of leaders who do not think of ourselves more highly than we ought, but with sober judgment. We do want to be leaders who are filled with the Spirit and all the fruit that he produces and so on and so forth.
I think that's right. I mean, Jesus teaching about sort of the Gentiles who lorded over one another. There's an expectation that that is the way that worldly political leaders will act. The church is meant to be entirely different. So sometimes I think we can have a wrong expectation of worldly political leaders that they ought to be like church leaders, whereas actually the New Testament leads us not to expect that. It's natural to try to make moral evaluations of leaders and question the way that they're operating. I think the other thing we need to bear in mind is that God can work through leaders irrespective of their moral flaws and their behavior. So, I mean, you talked about Donald Trump's kind of high view of himself in that idea. He's only accountable to his own morality. I suspect that sort of Cyrus, the king of the Persian Empire, probably yes. thought of himself rather like that.
I'm sure.
And yet actually Isaiah describes him as the servant of God because he was used to be the one who issued the decree allowing the Jews to return from exile to rebuild the temple. So actually, even world leaders who we might see as being deeply flawed at a moral level and will be accountable to God for might actually, in the strange providence of God, be used as part of the accomplishment of his kind of purposes. And I think we just need to have that theological perspective before we rush to judgment. Mm. And there's a difference between the moral failings of an individual for which they may be accountable and the providential ways in which God may have chosen to use them. I think the danger for us as Christians is with worldly political leaders is leaping on either demonizing them or idolizing them and thinking they're going to be put in one or other category. Mm. Whereas instead, I think we have to say in a flawed world, God may be working through very flawed people. Yeah.
Wise as ever, brothers. Thank you for giving us a good perspective on that from a Christian leadership viewpoint.
One last thing on Phil. The way that we pray in church, the way that we talk about these things, we are teaching all the time. I think we need to be aware of that. I think that's why it's so important, by the way, that leaders need to do at least some of the praying in church. Mm. I'm not wholly in favor of just, you know, giving out all the parts of the church to other people so they can contribute. I think you lead in church, not just by preaching, but by praying as well. And I think the tone that we set in our prayers as we pray for the world is very important in how we teach people about these situations.
Which are some of the key Christian virtues: faith, hope, and endurance. Mm. Those are what we need to have as a church in an unstable world with all of these things happening.
Let's talk about a church leader who has had to step back from ministry this week after confessing an 8-year affair. Philip Yancey, the author and minister, who has confessed that he has been having an adulterous relationship for the past 8 years. He has disqualified himself from ministry by his own admission. He has stepped back from his writings and his public engagements. And people have been shocked, staggered, disappointed, all of the above. And we just see how horrific sin is, don't we, here, laid bare once again.
Mm. I mean, I don't really know what to say about it other than that is true. I mean, I think it's interesting the way he's reacted. We ought to say always, of course, if you do with these stories, that there are real people involved, especially his wife.
And he's acknowledged that, and the husband of the woman he had an affair with, absolutely.
So I think that, you know, these aren't just cold stories out there. They affect real people. I think his response, I mean, we don't quite know all the details. Was he found out and he would have carried on if he hadn't been found out? We don't know the details, so it's difficult to say. But having come out into the open, his response is entirely correct and Christian. Mm. And actually, in contrast to other disgraced leaders who have just reinstated themselves into ministry. So I think it is the right response. He is quite unwell. He's got Parkinson's disease. And I think he's probably nearing the end of his life, isn't he? And some people have said cynically, but it may be true as well, well, he's just come out now because he's at that stage of life. I don't know if that's true or not. But I think what's striking about it to me is the contrast we see here with other fallen leaders who have refused to accept the mistakes they've made and acknowledge that they have sinned and to be open and public about that and to confess their sin. I think that's really important. And it's a stage that sadly we've seen missing in others, even if there are other things about this that are obviously not, you know, not good.
One of the titles I've got on my shelf is What's So Amazing About Grace? And the amazing thing is there is grace even for this, isn't there? We need to remember that as well.
I think that's right. I mean, it is tragically sad, and that's because his books have been really, really helpful and useful. I've read his book, What's So Amazing About Grace? He wrote a great book on prayer. It's important to remember that the truths that are explained in those books remain true, irrespective of his own personal fall and his own personal sin, because the gospel is not dependent on the moral character of Christians who teach it and explain it. So it naturally causes us to question leaders, but it shouldn't cause us to question the gospel and the truths of scripture that are taught by that. But I mean, it's inevitably painful. I think in my life as a Christian, there have been a number of significant falls, which were shocking. I think for me personally, Roy Clements was kind of a really massive moment of just immense personal grief of somebody I knew. Ian Campbell in Scotland was an appalling abusive situation within the life of a church. Again, I found that very shocking, somebody I'd heard and had read. And there comes a point over your Christian life where you think, actually, you do discover that this is happening. It's a reality. We shouldn't pretend that it doesn't happen. And we need to remember that for the vast majority of faith of Christian ministers and leaders and teachers, they are faithful to Christ, and we should rejoice in that. But inevitably, there will be high profile people whose sin comes to light. I agree with Adrian. The way he seems to have dealt with it and spoken about it has been right and appropriate in how to respond to that situation. I think the things that particularly strike me, it's a reminder, here is somebody who was engaging in an affair at a relatively late stage of life. I think we can think that these are dangers that are problems for young men. Yeah, yeah. Whereas actually here is somebody who actually was clearly sort of much older. And I think that ought to help us just to be on our guard, both personally and also in our churches. We can make assumptions that these are challenges for certain kinds of people, certain ages of people. Obviously, we think this is a consensual relationship, so it's not just him, it's the other person who was engaging in this. And it's very hard to think, how does somebody manage that for 8 years whilst maintaining a public front? That reminds us of the danger of the deceptiveness of our hearts, even when we are people who might be seeking to follow Christ. So it's a reminder to be on our guard against those dangers, to protect and watch over our marriages where we are married. So I think there are lessons for us to take for ourselves. The other thing we've got to do is avoid leaping to instant then suspicion of everyone. One of the challenges in the Christian community is when something like this happens, people start beginning to think, well, maybe everybody is doing that. Everybody needs to, in a sense, set up restrictions on who they can talk to, what kind of ministry they can be involved in. Again, I think that's a dangerous, unscriptural counter-reaction that's understandable, but isn't actually helpful for gospel ministry and leadership. I mean, I still remember Don Carson talking about the challenges of sexual temptation in ministry, which his message was essentially stay behind the desk. Whatever you do, stay behind the desk. But there's an assumption behind that I am counseling and teaching people, but I'm doing it in a public space in a way in which I maintain distance. And I think that's a helpful sort of basic principle.
We grieve over that and for all those who have been involved in it. Got a couple of minutes left, brothers. Let's talk about the past weekend, one of my favourite weekends of the year, which is FA Cup third round weekend.
This is keeping up John's New Year's resolution.
Yeah, to talk more about
a football story every day.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, the greatest ever giant killing was back in 1993 when Bolton beat Liverpool 2-0 at Anfield. Goals from John McGinley and Andy Walker, YouTube it. But of course, it's been eclipsed this weekend by Macclesfield Town, knocking out the holders, Crystal Palace, no less, 117 places lower than them in the league rankings, which makes it, on paper at least, the greatest ever giant killing.
The last time the holders were knocked out by a non-league team was in 1907.
Okay.
And it was Crystal Palace, I think, who knocked them out.
Oh, that's very interesting. We're saying Liverpool were the holders when Bolton knocked them out in 93. Just saying, YouTube it. But there's a fascinating story because it's a giant killing, isn't it?
Before it's a giant killing story, Phil, it's a revitalisation story.
Oh, because of Macclesfield Town and the story
Macclesfield Town went bust, were in all kinds of trouble. They had to be restarted from nothing with a little team of people who were committed to it, including Robbie Savage, actually.
The owner bought the ground off Rightmove.
He did. It is a great story. So it is a revitalization story, and they had to start right at the bottom. And they are still pretty much they're in step six. Harbour Town, the mighty Harbour Town, are in step seven. So, I mean, they're still a lowly, very lowly team. So it is a giant killing. We'll come on to that. But it is also just a reminder that sometimes the work of the church is starting very small and sometimes staying very small for a long time before anything great happens. And sometimes even nothing great does happen. You just sort of plod on. And there's a great work that lots of people are doing in our churches, a revitalization. If you're one of those listening, the Lord bless you. And if you're in a larger church and there are churches around you that need revitalizing, if there are Macclesfield towns, I would want to say, go for it.
It's interesting. Producer Joel and I were talking about this earlier today. And he said, you know, even the term giant killing is a reference to David and Goliath. It's there in the culture, isn't it? This idea that that the giant can be slain by somebody smaller. It's quite interesting, really. It's in the kind of zeitgeist.
I've got David and Goliath open in front
of me. Oh, have you? Okay, very good.
1 Samuel 17. Yeah. If you're watching, I've got my visual open.
Yeah, very good.
The interesting thing about David and Goliath, I think, is that David appeared to be a minnow, but he was not because the law was on his side. There is a kind of contrast, really. And that's the extraordinary thing, of course, about the Crystal Palace Macclesfield thing, that it does look like a David and Goliath story. But most people, when they use that as a mantra, they don't know enough about the David and Goliath story to know that David looked weak, he looked insignificant, he looked nothing, but he was nothing of the sort because the Lord, his God, was on his side. I think it's actually a beautiful picture of the gospel that Jesus, in his crucifixion, looks weak, looks insignificant, looks nothing, but he is the anointed Messiah, the Son of God, full of the Spirit. And actually, therefore, he's able to overcome the massive challenge of the evil one and be victorious. So it's not quite David and Goliath, actually, if you really understand David and Goliath. It's still a great story.
And we can feel weak sometimes as the church, John, but this is a good reminder that we're not weak because we have the Lord.
I think that's absolutely right. But it's inherent, isn't it, with the FA Cup and football, that actually the whole goal is to win and triumph. Therefore, which is why we naturally, as English people, love the underdog winning the occasion. But it's very important we don't translate that into Christian ministry, which I think can easily be done. There are people who want to be part of the mega church, the successful church, the church that is better and bigger than all the other churches, and they find their identity in that. I think this story actually reminds us of the vital importance of local churches that are serving their community, as you say, revitalization. I listened to the interview with the owner of Macclesfield Town on that sort of news kind of the other morning. It was just great hearing his story of kind of investing in this club, taking it on, and how it's now serving the community of Macclesfield, how the people are coming, 3,000 people every week, and it becomes a focus of life within the community. It doesn't have to be Liverpool. It doesn't have to be Manchester United to be
even Bolton
significantly serving. And we can see that in Harborough. We've got a kind of football club in the centre of the town, Harborough Town, which again, there's a good number of people coming.
Your dad's there every week.
He is. It's part of our local community life. And we shouldn't devalue that just because it doesn't look like a Liverpool or a Manchester United or whatever. And actually, the vast majority of local churches are not mega churches that seem to be competing in the premiership. They are basically local groups of people who are serving in their communities. And I think we want to really value and appreciate that. And actually the Lord sees that and that will be rewarded in the end. They don't actually have to compete with the other bigger churches. They just actually need to be really good at being what they are. Yeah. Serving people. And I guess at FIEC, our conviction is the importance of local church. And we're not just serving big churches or churches that are well known. We're 675 churches. Most of those, most people will never have heard of. They're relatively small, medium-sized local churches reaching people in a town, a suburb, a community. But that's where God's work is done. And I think we need to really appreciate and support that.
And Phil, if you're a Bolton supporter, dare I say, or a Palace supporter, or indeed a Philadelphia Eagles supporter this morning. Oh dear, oh dear. Sport is quite redemptive. There's always next season. And there are setbacks in church life. Yeah. There are sometimes significant setbacks where you think, you know, we're the holders. We've been knocked out by a nothing team. People are going to be, you know, singing about us in the terraces for the next 10 years about this. And don't worry, this next season. And I think there's something very redemptive about football and indeed about church life. There are setbacks, there are difficulties, but there's always another Christmas service to preach at till the Lord returns. There's always another moment. And I think, you know, we do get knocked down by our setbacks, but we need to not despair. There is always something more to do with serving the Lord.
Things are so bad for Bolton at the moment that there's always the next game, which is where we're sort of
landing. I read an article in the paper, actually, that was reviewing England's kind of test performance.
That's not redemptive.
I thought there was nothing very much redemptive in that. But actually, the article was brilliant because it basically said, on the basis of this series, we can see that England are going to win in 2027, which I thought was actually the triumph of optimism over reality.
Well, we shall see what happens. Brothers, time has beaten us. Thank you so much for talking about some of the stories that have been making the news and what's been a very busy new year for news. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it. We hope this has helped you as you lead your churches where you are, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon. God bless.
See you.